Because of where I happened to be born, when and to whom, I had opportunities that other people don't have. And I didn't do a thing to earn that, and that's not fair. And I want to help level the playing field.
Today's episode is sponsored by EncourageX, where you can manage all of your encouragement needs in one place. Personal, authentic, and consistent. EncourageX.com, where relationships mean everything.
Welcome to this episode of Our Voices Matter. We're so excited to have with us Elena Marks, who is the president and CEO of the Episcopal Health Foundation, which is all about giving a voice to those who don't necessarily have access to healthcare. And of course, healthcare is such a huge, huge issue that we're facing in this country right now. So Elena, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So happy to have you here. So explain to our audience what Episcopal Health Foundation is all about. What is your goal? What are you trying to accomplish?
So our goal is to help the 11 million people who live in the 57 counties that comprise the Episcopal Diocese of Texas live healthy lives, and we're especially focused on low-income and vulnerable populations.
What is the biggest challenge that you're facing?
Oh, we're facing a lot of challenges. The biggest challenge, frankly, is that everyone's obsessed with health care, and yet if you really want to achieve good health outcomes, health care is only a really small part. And in this country, we are spending tons and tons of money and tons of attention on health care, which is important, but health care only contributes 20% to health outcomes. So how long you live and how healthy you are while you're living is more dependent on many other factors than on health care, and yet we are obsessed with health care.
Right, right. So what are those other factors, that other 80%?
The other 80%, which loosely in the literature go by the name social determinants of health, include economic factors. For instance, income, education level, housing, transportation, social cohesion, access to healthy food, lifestyle issues. Do you exercise? Do you have the opportunity to exercise? Substance abuse, smoking, environmental concerns, pollution, transportation, all of these things together make a decision about whether or not you actually live a healthy life. And access to health care and affordable health care is really important, but it's only a 20% contributor to the outcomes.
So what is the conversation that we're not having that we need to have as it relates to health care, and especially for those whose voices are not typically heard, the uninsured, underinsured, low income, people who just don't have the platform to say, hey, you know, pay attention to me, here's what I need. What should we be talking about?
First of all, we should be talking about health, not just health care. And we should stop using the words health and health care interchangeably. Many of us do it. I catch myself doing it from time to time. We say health care when what we really mean is health. Health care means medical services. And that's just a means to an end. There is no inherent value in medical care except to the extent that it contributes to your health. And so what we really want is health. We want good, healthy people who live long, productive, satisfying lives. But what we talk about is health care. And that's a piece, but it's a small piece of the puzzle. And if we don't change the conversation, we're going to keep talking about a 20% factor instead of opening up the conversation to say, what does it really take for a person to live a healthy life? And for a low-income and vulnerable populations, these other factors are really critical. If you are living in an apartment that is full of mold and has poor pest control, you are exposed to indoor pollution that can exacerbate asthma and all sorts of other health conditions. That needs to be remediated. There's nothing that a doctor can do about that. And we have so many people who are living in circumstances that conspire against their being able to live a healthy life. And doctors can't do anything about that.
So what is the Episcopal Health Foundation doing differently. How are you approaching this in a way that other organizations are not?
So what we try to do is get the health system, including the health care system, to focus on health and not just health care. So let me give you a couple of concrete examples. We work with a clinic in the greater Houston area. It's called the Hope Clinic, and it serves a lot of refugees and immigrants, including a large population of Asian women who work in nail salons. And if you work in a nail salon, you are exposed to all sorts of chemicals. And these women would present at the clinic with health problems. And so those problems can get treated, but what the clinic recognized was that the health problem the women were experiencing had to do with their work environment. And there was nothing that a doctor sitting in a clinic can do about that. And so what this clinic did was go beyond the exam room. First, they started working with the nail salon owners to educate them on better products they might be using, on the equipment and protective gear that the nail salon workers might be using to protect them. Then they took it even a step further and they started working with the training schools that train people who want to become licensed to be nail technicians so that they would incorporate that into their curriculum. And so this is a medical provider that instead of waiting for people to come to them sick and saying, gosh, let's see what we can do about you being sick, went into the community and moved upstream to actually solve the root cause of health problems.
And so what is the, so how does the foundation factor in that? Are you funding this provider?
We are funding.
What's the connection there?
We're funding this provider. And here's a subtle and sort of tricky way of explaining why we're approaching it the way we're approaching it. So we could have said, wow, nail salons are dangerous places. We're going to go and work with nail salons and work with the nail salon education system and get them to do a better job. But what we are doing is working with healthcare providers, because that's where the money is, and saying to them, you know what, you've captured almost 19% of GDP. You're not producing health outcomes. We want to help you learn to move upstream and learn to do this kind of work. So we look for providers, and they find us, because doctors are frustrated when people keep coming into their clinics over and over again with the same problems, and there's nothing that they can do because the root cause of that problem
is not being
medical.
Addressed.
Right.
Well, it's not medical, and it's not
being
addressed.
And so, okay. Historically, the clinics have been like, oh, well, you know, too bad, gee, that's a shame, you live in a bad environment, work in a bad environment, have all these other problems. Increasingly, you are seeing healthcare providers say, that's not good enough, we need to go beyond the exam room. And what we're trying to see, what we're seeing on a national level, and it's happening really slowly, but it is happening, is we're finally having a conversation about the limits of healthcare and the need to do more than just provide clinical services to make people healthy. And the way it'll really change is when we start paying for a clinic to go beyond just medical services. Right now, we have $3.5 trillion in this economy invested in primarily medical services. A third of that's in hospitals. About a quarter of it is paid to doctors and other clinicians. About 10% is pharmaceuticals, and then a variety of other things. But all of that money is going into healthcare, even when it doesn't solve the health problem. And so what we're seeing is payers, including the federal government, are putting pressure on healthcare providers and saying, it's not okay to just provide a medical service if the medical service ends up being of no benefit to a person who goes back out into the same environment. And so as those payment systems shift, which is happening really slowly, there's an opening to shift the conversation so that if we have a health system that controls 19% of GDP, what I'd say to them, that's great, keep the money, but produce health outcomes. It's okay that we're spending 19% on health. What's not okay is that we're ranked number 37
Texas is.
In the, no,
oh,
the
I'm
U.S.
I'm talking about the United States.
The U.S.
Okay.
Yes.
Texas is last in, well, in
Texas is last in a whole lot of things.
Yeah, that's another conversation.
Okay,
let's go there.
but we have a country that for the last 100 years became hooked on and fascinated with doctors and medicine and technology and science as the solution to everything. And in many cases, it was. And we've made huge advances. And I'm not here to say healthcare is unimportant, no one should have it, blah, blah, blah. What I am here to say is we have overinvested in that at the expense of really more mundane things that actually allow people
to
be
helped.
Right.
Right.
And so if you think about obesity and all of the diseases that are tied to obesity, whether it's diabetes or heart disease, you can treat diabetes with insulin. You can treat heart disease with all sorts of drugs and procedures. But you can prevent or better manage a whole lot of that through diet and exercise. And if people don't have the opportunity or the means to have a good diet and to have exercise opportunities, it doesn't matter what the doctor says or does.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we're only paying for doctors.
So I want to shift the conversation just a little bit. As you know, this podcast is about sharing stories and trying to help return civil discourse in the middle of this political divide. Healthcare is a topic that is front and center when it comes to the division that we're experiencing. There are, you know, we're talking about healthcare for immigrants. Mm-hmm. Should they have it? Should they not? I'm just curious about your thoughts about the consequence of the political divide on our healthcare system. What is that consequence, do you think?
I think it is lack of progress. It results in lack of progress where there could be progress. And I don't want to blame any person, any party, because that's a zero-sum game.
Right.
The law of the land today is the Affordable Care Act. I personally believe that it was a huge step forward in advancing access to health care through affordable health insurance for millions of Americans. It's not perfect. It's not the only way it could have done. May not be the best way it could have been done, but it is the law of the land, and it has made tremendous progress in bringing a lot of people into the health insurance system, which is your gateway to the health care system, which I would argue is your gateway to the health system, that otherwise were simply going to be left out in the cold. And if you look at the components of the ACA, and the fact that it built on a private health insurance system, it didn't include a public option, and it did include an individual mandate. That was a plan that came out of the Republican Party. The idea for the individual mandate was hatched at the Heritage Foundation. The first place this was implemented, an ACA mini, was under Governor Mitt Romney in Massachusetts.
Right.
So when it moved to the federal level, you had people from the left going, oh my God, you're going to adopt this Republican plan? And you had people from the right going, those are Democrats trying to put up a plan. We can't have that plan. And nobody was looking at what are the components and are we moving the ball forward in a positive way?
And are we having an impact on the people whose lives are dependent upon what we do?
And in a fiscally responsible manner. I do believe that costs matter and that we have to be honest about what things cost. And if we're honest about what things cost, we can make a decision as a country as to whether we want to spend money in a particular way or not. So I don't want to say everybody should have everything for free and, you know, we'll just go into debt forever over it. I really don't believe in that. But I think the ACA was an excellent starting point, and we were making actually really good progress. So all but 14 states expanded Medicaid, which allowed millions of people across the country access to health care for the first time. Texas did not do that, so we have more than a million people in Texas who would have been eligible for health insurance under a Medicaid expansion, but who were left out in the cold because of that, and there's simply not another mechanism for them. They can, I guess, theoretically, they can buy in the private insurance market, but they can't afford
it.
And they're not eligible for the ACA subsidies. So they really are falling into a gap. Mm-hmm. We could have worked on that program in Texas, but Texas has refused to do that. We've also seen over the last several years an erosion of the Affordable Care Act and intentional undermining by the federal government of the Affordable Care Act. And what has happened is that we have seen a drop-off in the rate of insured people. For the first time in decades after the ACA was implemented, we saw the number and percentage of insured Americans rise steeply. Starting in 2017, for the first time in a really long time, that number started dropping and the number of uninsured started rising. And that to me is going backwards. And it's the product of bickering over labels as opposed to looking at actual policies. And it's not, so what I've been saying has makes it sound like, oh, the Republicans are out tearing down the ACA. Here's a feature of the ACA that the Democrats actually have been party to tearing down, and that is the so-called Cadillac tax. One of the features of the ACA was to implement a tax on health plans that are sponsored usually by employers or labor unions that are very rich in benefits. And the reason the tax was imposed is because there's an economic theory that says that if you give people essentially carte blanche to use as many health care services as they want, whenever they want them, without regard to need or cost for themselves, they'll just do it. And that the government ends up subsidizing that, and that's bad policy. It's bad medical policy, it's bad fiscal policy. And when the Cadillac tax was part of the original ACA, immediately, like with many other provisions, people started campaigning against it. Well, the Democrats just led the effort to repeal or at least delay again indefinitely into the future the Cadillac tax. That's backwards progress.
So there's plenty of blame to go around.
There's plenty of blame to go around.
So what do you think is the answer? I mean, how do we get beyond this political division, the name calling, the labeling that happens and affects so many other sectors, I mean, every aspect of our lives at this point, but specifically as it relates to healthcare, what would you like to see happen?
I'd like to see people look at facts and data and make arguments, pro or con, whatever is being proposed, based on facts and data and not party identity or ideological scrutiny. And I would say that applies to everything, not just to health care.
Yeah.
But that would go a long way to talking about what is the problem we want to solve. Everyone seems to agree that it is better to have more people insured rather than fewer people insured. So if you can agree on that, then the question becomes, how do you do that in the most effective and cost-effective manner?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different discussion than those people don't deserve health care versus health care is a fundamental right. That's when I hear that conversation and people say, do you believe it's a fundamental right? It's like, that's not the question. You can go there, but then you're moving into ideological camps, and it's not necessary to get to the point of everyone agreeing that access to health care that is affordable is a positive thing for society. You can believe that government ought to have no role in that, but I bet you can't find more than a handful of people who say it's not even important if people have access to care. People don't believe that. They disagree over how you get there, but not whether you ought
whether
to be trying
to, be trying
get,
to
there.
Get there. Yeah.
But that's not what we talk about. Instead of saying, so, okay, we want to get another 5 million people covered. What's the best way to do that? Here are 10 proposals.
Well, and I think too that in the middle of this debate and all of the name calling and labeling that goes on, we forget about the human beings that we're fighting for, you know, that we're trying to create policy for. I'm curious about any stories that the nail salon story was really interesting to me, and I'm wondering if in your role, if you have an opportunity to talk to everyday folks who are not insured and who do not have a voice.
We do through our grantees on a regular basis.
What are they saying? What are you hearing from the people?
What you're hearing is that, well, now what you're hearing, because of all the rhetoric around immigration and particularly the public charge rule, you're hearing that people are too afraid to go to even trusted providers looking for information or services. Aside from that, what you hear is that people don't have enough money to get the care they need, and they are afraid. And the stress of being afraid adds to afraid of not having enough money to get the care you need, adds to their health issues and makes them more likely to have health issues. Mm-hmm. We find people who are frustrated that our system is so complicated. Even if you are insured, you can talk to people who are well insured. They don't understand what their policy includes and doesn't include, and they often find out the hard way. I mean, all the conversation around surprise billing, balance billing, and who's in network.
Yeah, and in that camp.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's not just low income or vulnerable or uneducated people who are frustrated with the system. We have a system that's very complicated and just not accessible because it's like a big black box to a lot of people. And if you add to it not speaking English well, not having transportation, not having insurance or resources to pay for whatever care you need, you're just compounding it.
Right.
And the kinds of people we care about are those people, and the groups that we fund are groups that work with those populations because they want to do it.
I'm curious about your passion for this this topic, the healthcare, and I know you're also an attorney by training and profession. What's your backstory? Why are you so passionate about this?
It's a social justice thing for me. It's a recognition, I guess, as a young adult, that the things that I had in life, I feel like I've worked hard, but I grew up middle class, two parents, white. I have a good education. I lived in a safe environment, and I like to feel like I made the most of my educational and job opportunities, but because of where I happened to be born, when and to whom, I had opportunities that other people don't have. And I didn't do a thing to earn that, and that's not fair. And I want to help level the playing field. And I do this work in the health space, but frankly, I could have done it in housing or education or racial injustice or criminal justice or any other way. It's just not fair. I am so lucky, and it's not fair. I mean, I look at little bitty children who have the potential to be anything in the world, and they will never fulfill that potential, and didn't have the same opportunities that my kids had simply because of to whom they were born, and it's just not fair. And I want to do what I can to change that. I'm doing it in the health space, and the reason we try to do it at the system level is because that's where real change occurs. We could improve on a marginal basis the lives of a handful of people, but if we can change the system, if we can get the powers that be, the government, the large payers, to change what they pay for so that they're paying for people to actually get health, that's where the real opportunity lives.
Changing what they are paying for. So they're paying, what you're saying is they're paying for the care and not the health.
Exactly. That you Yes, I'll say no more.
They're paying for the care and not the health.
So yes.
We really have to flip the switch.
Yes.
In terms of how we think about this, as you were saying, and how we talk about it.
Right. And if we're going to spend $3.5 trillion on national health expenditures, then what are the outcomes we want to achieve? Because if those outcomes are longer life expectancy, lower infant mortality, lower obesity rates, we're not doing it with the way we're spending the money today. And so if we said our most prized outcome is to reduce infant mortality, there's a medical care component to it, but there is a much bigger social care component to it that we're just not doing, that has to do with society and justice and race and housing and
all those things. Sticky topics that it's so hard for us to talk about.
Yes.
Which is why we have this podcast and many other things that are out there, people like me who are trying to move the conversation forward in a positive way. But those are, you know, I'm glad you expressed it the way you did, you know, talking about how you grew up and what your privilege was and how just by virtue of the time and place and to whom you were born, mm-hmm. it's a completely different playing field,
yes,
than it is for someone of color born in a different circumstance.
Yep.
It's difficult for some people to hear that and to understand it when it comes from a person of color. But to have somebody like you in your position say it is very powerful. I'm sure you know that.
It's just a fact. I mean, I don't feel like it's some like brave statement. It is a fact. Sometimes I feel guilty about it. I don't really have anything to feel guilty for because my circumstances are my circumstances. Mm-hmm. But that, I feel, gives me an obligation to help others, that somebody who didn't have these built-in advantages, unearned built-in advantages. And it doesn't take anything from me, away from me, to help others. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not that if somebody else has an opportunity, I lose one. I just don't believe
it's
that's true.
It's not that
true.
Scarcity mentality.
No.
I know. That's also at the root, yeah, of our division, is the whole scarcity,
right,
mentality.
Right. If you get it, then
I
lose.
If you get it, then I lose. You know, what's mine is mine, and you can't have any. Because if I give up some of what I got, then, you know, I'm sorry, but I, you know, I worked hard for this. And you could very easily have that attitude if that's who you were as a person, and clearly you're not. But a lot of us do have that attitude. I worked hard for this. You know, I don't see why I have privilege. I mean, this is mine, and there's just not enough to go around. But the reality is there is.
There is. And what drives me crazy is people who confuse merit with grace. Mm. And I'd like to think I have merited some of what I have, but I had the opportunity to merit it because of grace. And I can't forget that.
I love that. I've never heard it put that way before. That's so beautiful the way you said that. So,
thanks.
I think that's a great place for us to wrap this up, because I don't know where we go from here other than to say, let's give each other a little grace. How about that?
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Elena Marks, thank you so much. I really enjoyed having you. And thank you for watching and listening and for giving Elena permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. We'll see you next time. I'm a firm believer that if we can find a way to better understand each other's experiences, we can find a way to accept and respect each other for who we are, even when we don't agree. That's the ultimate goal of this podcast. So with that in mind, what do you want the world to know about your story? How might your story, your truth, provide an important perspective to help bridge our divides? If you'd like to share your story with us for a chance to be featured on the podcast, all you have to do is go to our website, ourvoicesmatterpodcast.com, and click on What's Your Story? We can't wait to hear from you, because your voice matters.